This is the Clinical Pharmacology Podcast with Nathan Tuescher, where I discuss clinical pharmacology and pharmacometrics topics from the perspective of drug development scientists. In this episode, I want to discuss some nuances of non-compartmental analysis, or NCA. Most listeners likely have some experience with NCA, regardless of whether you're a student or maybe you have 10 years of work experience. What I want to discuss are some of the assumptions and methods used in NCA and how they can affect your results. Because NCA is used in every single investigational drug application or marketing authorization request, I think a clear understanding of how the calculations are performed can be a good reminder when you're planning a study or performing an analysis of study data. This discussion will not be a comprehensive lecture on all NCA parameters. Instead, I'll focus on a few parameters that are commonly used and discuss those. You will want to look at the show notes today on my website, tuesschersolutions.com, to see some of the images that I will describe in the podcast. Non-compartmental analysis, or NCA, is a method of analyzing concentration time data. It's called non-compartmental because it does not involve fitting data to a mathematical model. Instead, it uses the observed concentration time data pairs to calculate a variety of pharmacokinetic parameters. Some of the most common parameters calculated using NCA are Cmax, Tmax, area under the curve, or AUC, and half-life. In this episode, I'm going to focus on three separate parameters, Cmax, AUC, and the terminal elimination rate constant. These three are the most commonly used parameters to describe drug exposure. I'll discuss the basic methodology for each and then discuss challenges that may arise when you're performing an analysis. Cmax is the maximum observed concentration in a given PK profile. The value is observed and not calculated. So you might be wondering why I want to discuss this parameter. The fact that it is observed and not calculated can lead to a lot of confusion about how to interpret the information. And the timing of sampling can have a very large impact on the interpretation of the Cmax that's reported. Let's start with a simple explanation of how you determine Cmax. You take all the concentration measurements over a dosing interval, and then you take the largest concentration, and that's your Cmax. So if you have a single dose and collect samples to 120 hours, then you take all of your data from dose time to 120 hours post-dose, and the largest concentration value is your Cmax. There's another parameter called Tmax, which is the time at which Cmax occurs. So if your highest concentration is 350 nanograms per mil and that sample is taken at 2 hours post-dose, then your Cmax is 350 nanograms per mil and your Tmax is 2 hours. If you're dosing to steady state with once daily dosing, then perhaps you have data from dose administration through 24 hours on day 14. Again, the highest measured concentration in that 24-hour interval is your Cmax, and the time of that sample relative to the last dose taken is your Tmax. So you might be wondering, where's the difficulty with this? It's a pretty simple parameter. It's the highest value. Anybody can pick that out. It has everything to do with the study design for taking blood samples for analysis. So I think it's easiest to explain using an example. Imagine we have an oral product administered once a day, and we're going to sample over 24 hours on day 14. Let's say we plan on taking 10 blood samples over 24 hours. We take 5 samples over the first 4 hours when we expect the Tmax, and then we take the remaining 5 samples over the rest of the 20 hours in the day. In this situation, we're likely to get a pretty good estimate of Cmax because we have several samples at the expected time of the peak concentration. But now let's imagine a separate scenario where we have the same oral product administered once a day, but we only take 4 blood samples over the 24-hour period. Perhaps we have 2 samples in the first 4 hours and then 2 samples in the remaining 20 hours of the day. In this situation, we may have difficulty getting a good estimate of Cmax because of the sparseness of the samples. For clinical studies in healthy adult volunteers, you can often collect an adequate number of samples like the first situation. But in clinical studies in patients or pediatric subjects, they might be more similar to the second situation. And almost all non-clinical studies are somewhere in the middle of these two situations, but tend towards the second, where there's too few samples for an individual subject to adequately characterize the Cmax. So in the majority of studies, you'll be faced with the challenge of how do you capture Cmax? And it's really a design issue, not a data analysis issue. But there are some solutions. So one common solution used in non-clinical studies is to stagger the sampling times across groups of animals. So perhaps you have 10 sampling time points, but each animal only gives 2 blood samples. So you create different groups of animals assigned to different time points to give coverage to all 10 time points. Maybe you have 3 animals per group, 2 sampling time points for each group. That means you need 5 groups of animals to cover the 10 time points. That means you need 15 animals. This method does cover all the 10 time points, but you end up with an average profile for analysis. So you don't get multiple estimates of the Cmax. Instead, it's a single estimate with no real variability assessment. In addition, if you want to have different groups, all of a sudden you start doubling the number of animals. So if you need 15 animals that are male and you need 15 animals that are female, and if you have different treatment levels, then you need 15 animals at all those treatment levels for male and 15 more for female at that treatment level. So another solution is to decide that you want to focus on one parameter at the expense of others. So if Cmax is really important, but the terminal slope is not, you can group your limited number of samples around the Tmax and not take samples in the elimination phase. So if you go back to, we can only take 4 samples per subject, maybe you take all 4 samples in the absorption phase around Tmax. That allows you to have individual Cmax estimates and you can get a good mean value and the variability of that mean, but you have to give up something. You give up the ability to calculate other parameters like AUC and the terminal elimination rate constant. All these trade-offs need to be considered when designing the study and the sampling schedule. There's yet another challenge with the Cmax determination in NCA. So let's consider you have a planned blood samples at 2, 3, and 4 hours post-dose to capture the Cmax. And let's say you have 50% of the subjects with a Cmax at 3 hours and 50% with a Cmax at 4 hours. So the average Tmax will be 3.5 hours, but you don't have any samples at 3.5 hours. The three hour samples are likely less than Cmax because they're on the upswing as absorption is dominating. But the 4 hour samples are also less than Cmax because they're on the downswing after elimination starts dominating. So while the Tmax estimate is accurate, the Cmax estimates will be lower than the real maximum exposure for the subjects. You might think you can fix this by simply changing the sampling profile to 3, 3.5, and 4 hours post-dose. But what you might find is that 75% of the subjects have a Tmax of 3.5 hours and 25 subjects have a Tmax of 4 hours. The average Tmax would then be 3.625 hours. And again, you won't have any samples at that time point. Both the 3.5 and 4 hour samples would be below the real Cmax. You can keep doing this and putting sampling time points closer and closer together, but you'll never be able to come up with the real or true Cmax, because the actual Tmax likely occurs sometime in between your 2 sampling time points. Thus, any Cmax from NCA is an underestimate of the true Cmax. This is critical to understand when reporting exposures for comparisons across studies and species. The real exposure is probably higher than what you determined from the NCA data. In this situation, there really isn't a remedy, but understanding this nuance is important when you're interpreting the results of an analysis. Let's talk about area under the curve, or AUC. I specifically want to address 2 different methods of calculating AUC and the pros and cons of each one. As the name indicates, AUC is the total area under the concentration time curve. The calculation is performed by converting the profile into a set of trapezoids and calculating the area of each trapezoid and then summing them up together. In some cases, there is an extrapolation from the last observed time point to infinity. However, I won't be discussing that today. There's 2 different methods for calculating AUC that are commonly used. One is called the linear method, and the other goes by different names, but some are the logarithmic method or the linear up log down method. I'll describe the linear method first and then move on to the linear up log down method. The linear method involves creating a trapezoid with four data points. These include two adjacent concentration time points and two points with a concentration of zero at the same time point. This shape includes a horizontal line at the x-axis with two vertical lines from the x-axis up to the concentration values. You then have a line that connects the two concentration values. You can see an example image on my website using the link in the show notes. The area of that trapezoid is calculated by multiplying 1/2 times the height times the sum of the bases. In this case, the height is the difference in time between the two data points, or time for points 2 minus time for point 1. And the bases are the concentration values. As you think about the equation, what it is really doing is taking the average concentration, which is 1/2 times the sum of the two concentration values, and multiplying it by the time interval. The area of that rectangle is equivalent to the area of the trapezoid. Thus, linear AUC is kind of like taking the average concentration between two time points and creating a series of rectangles along the profile, then summing up all those rectangles to arrive at the final AUC. The linear up log down method makes a modification to the linear method based on what we have observed in many PK profiles, namely that the decline in concentrations is exponential, not linear. So to match this exponential decline, this method uses the linear calculation method when concentrations are increasing and the logarithmic method when concentrations are decreasing. The logarithmic trapezoid is calculated by multiplying the difference in time times the difference in concentrations divided by the natural log of the ratio of concentrations. There's a link to the derivation of that equation in the show notes. The logarithmic method will calculate a slightly smaller AUC than the linear method because it assumes that the concentration decline is exponential or concave rather than linear. And just like in the linear model, each individual trapezoid is summed up together to give the full AUC. So, which method is better? Which one should you use? In my opinion, you can use either one to calculate AUC. There's very little difference between these two methods when you have adequately spaced samples. So in most cases, the AUC is about 1% lower for the linear up log down method compared to the linear method. That difference is very small when you consider all the other factors that affect the variability in your non-clinical and clinical studies. If you have very sparse samples, there can be a bigger difference. However, with sparse samples, I don't think AUC is a reasonable metric to calculate using NCA approaches anyways. So you shouldn't really even calculate an AUC if all you have is sparse samples. In sparse sampling, you really should be using modeling. So I prefer to use the simple linear AUC method for all of my calculations. The linear up log down method does not really provide a dramatic improvement, but it does require slightly more complex equations for calculation. So I know that different organizations have preferred standards for one method of an AUC calculation. I really think those standards are designed for consistency within the organization rather than deciding what the quote unquote best method is for calculating AUC. The final parameter that I want to discuss is the terminal elimination rate constant. So this is calculated by taking a set of data points in the terminal phase of the profile and calculating the slope of a linear regression of the natural log transformed concentrations and the sampling time points. The negative of the slope value is the terminal elimination rate constant. That makes this sound simple, and honestly, it's a pretty simple computation. Where this gets complicated is choosing which time points to include in the calculation. There is not a standard for the number of time points to include in the calculation, although most people tend to include at least 3 samples. Nor is there a rule on the maximum number of concentrations you can include. There have been innumerable papers written on this topic, and I can't possibly cover all of them here. But there's a few common methods that I've seen used, and I'd like to discuss those. So the first method is a sequential method of selecting the optimum number of data points for this terminal slope calculation. So you start with the last three time points that are measurable, and you calculate the adjusted R squared value from the regression. Then you take the last four time points and see if the adjusted R squared value increases. And you keep adding more points until you maximize the adjusted R squared value. The adjusted R squared statistic is a measure of how well the fitted line represents the observed data points. Adjusted R squared values close to 1 are better, and close to 0 are bad. The adjusted R squared also includes a penalty function for including more data points. The second method uses what I call the eyeball test. In this method, a user manually selects the time points that give the best look to the terminal phase. If the calculated elimination rate constant meets predefined criteria, such as an R squared value greater than 0.6, then those selected time points are accepted as the best fit for that profile. The adjusted R squared method is probably the most common method that's used in most software, pharmacokinetic software packages. The eyeball test is used by some, but it really has the greatest probability of user bias. And some people use a combination where they start with the adjusted R squared method and then review each subject manually and adjust when they don't like the solution. So early in my career, I actually thought that this manual method was preferred because I could look at every single profile and ensure that the best fit was captured. But now after 20 years in the industry, I feel that the automated methods that use the adjusted R squared are pretty much adequate, and they're much, much faster than me looking through every single profile. My biggest concern with a terminal elimination rate constant is not the method of calculating the value, but instead how the value is used. I think we put way too much importance on this rate constant. So this terminal elimination rate constant represents the slowest process in the system. It's usually the elimination of a drug, but in certain cases where you have flip-flop kinetics, it can represent the absorption rate. More importantly, although the terminal rate follows exponential decline, it doesn't really adequately describe the full concentration time profile. Too often, the terminal elimination rate constant is used to calculate other parameters which do not accurately reflect the profile of the drug. For example, if you have a drug that exhibits one compartment kinetics, you can calculate the drug half-life by dividing the natural log of 2 by the elimination rate constant. But if your drug exhibits two compartment kinetics, you can still divide the natural log of 2 by the terminal elimination rate constant, but it won't really represent the half-life of the drug in your body. It only represents the half-life of the terminal phase of the profile. And if that terminal phase represents maybe 10% of total exposure, then that half-life is kind of meaningless. The same problem happens when you calculate volume of distribution using the elimination rate constant. So my concern is more how the parameter is used rather than how it is calculated. Whenever I work with clients, I try to avoid presenting or discussing half-lives or terminal elimination rate constants when I know that there are multi-compartment kinetics. I try to understand what the client wants to know rather than simply giving them a number that came out of the software package. I don't want to give a lecture to the clients on elimination rate constants, but I do want to understand what information they need to move forward and in their development program, and then find the best way to acquire that information for them. All right, let's summarize what we talked about today with respect to NCA assumptions and analysis methods. First, we talked about Cmax and some of the challenges associated with capturing it and how the sampling time points are of critical importance. Second, we reviewed the two common calculation methods for AUC. The linear method is my preference, but linear up log down method is completely valid if you use that. And then finally, I shared some thoughts on the calculation of the terminal elimination rate constants. So this is probably the most abused parameter in our specialty and can often lead development experts to make poor decisions. So thanks for joining me today, and please check out the show notes for links to a few articles I wrote on these topics, as well as a link to the images that I described in the show today. For more information, please connect with me on LinkedIn, send me an email to nathan@tushersolutions.com, or sign up for my newsletter at tushersolutions.com/newsletter. The newsletter is a copy of the show notes sent to your email each time an episode is released. Also, please subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to the show. Thank you.